Hello, I'm Theo, and I was the Member of Parliament for Stafford and chaired the UK Birth Trauma Inquiry in Parliament. And I have a beautiful daughter, but like many women, my birth was far from straightforward. I suffered from a traumatic birth after a 40-hour labour, postpartum hemorrhage, emergency surgery for my birth injury, and went on to develop PTSD. And it was this experience that led me to start campaigning nationally on ending the postcode lottery in maternity care. So Breaking the Taboo is a new podcast on women's health. And in series one, I'll be looking at the issue of birth trauma by speaking to affected mums and their families, healthcare professionals and campaigners. So if you, like me, feel like you didn't know where to ask for help, or you felt too ashamed to ask, then I hope you know you're not alone and that this podcast is very much here for you. Please get in touch with us with your stories and your reflections on the show, as we'd love to hear from you. And thanks to our sponsor, the law firm Irwin Mitchell. You can follow me on Instagram at Theo Clark MP, or do get in touch with us via our show website, which you'll find in the notes below. And now on to today's show. Well, hello and welcome to Breaking the Taboo. And I'm delighted to have two guests with me today, Dr. Kim Thomas and Jill Castle. Kim is Chief Executive of the Birth Trauma Association, and Jill is a former police officer who also suffered from a birth injury. So Kim, can I ask you to just introduce yourself to our guests today and explain your background and why you're here today to talk to us about birth trauma?
Yes, of course. Thank you very much, Theo. So I've been involved with the Birth Trauma Association for about 9 years, and I was also a freelance journalist for a long time. I started off as a press officer with the BTA. I'm now CEO, and our job as a charity is to support parents who have been through a traumatic birth experience and are psychologically affected by it. In the past few years, I've written two books on birth trauma, one which is aimed at mothers who experienced birth trauma, one aimed at health professionals. And I was also the secretariat for the Birth Trauma Parliamentary Inquiry early in 2024.
Fantastic. And hopefully we'll get on to talk a bit about the inquiry later on in the episode. Jill, would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes. Hello, everybody. My name is Jill Castle. As Theo has already touched on, I'm a former police officer. Back in 2011, I experienced a missed fourth degree tear, rectovaginal fistula and perineal abscess. All of these led to a permanent colostomy, which subsequently led to my medical retirement from the police because I also had a lot of post-traumatic stress and, you know, the other effects of a traumatic birth. I've campaigned for a long time on improving maternity services. I've worked a lot with the BTA, and I was also a member of the Special Advisory Group for the Birth Trauma APPG, which, of course, produced the report earlier this year.
Well, thank you both very much for joining us. And today is episode one, so I wanted to introduce our listeners to birth trauma. So, Kim, could I start with you? For people who are not aware of the term or might be concerned that they are exhibiting symptoms potentially of birth trauma, could you just explain what it is?
Yes, of course. Birth trauma is quite a broad term, so it's not a diagnostic category. I think that's the first thing to say. But we use it to describe psychological symptoms that you might experience having had a traumatic birth. And there's a whole range of symptoms, but they tend to be things like flashbacks, anxiety, difficulty bonding with your child, and so on. And in some cases, those symptoms may meet the threshold for a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. But even if you don't meet that threshold, lots of people find that their experience of traumatic birth is such that they do find it difficult because they're constantly reliving the trauma in their head. So we use birth trauma to refer to all those people.
What are the sort of main causes of birth trauma that you come across at the BTA?
Well, they tend to be medical emergencies. So quite often something goes wrong in the birth. Women tend to feel very fearful. Quite often women tell us they felt frightened they were going to die, or their baby was going to die. So it's quite often things like you know, suddenly the baby's heart rate dips and there's an emergency cesarean, or there's a very difficult forceps birth. Sometimes the baby gets stuck, and that can be very frightening. Sometimes women have tears, such as Jill had, or postpartum hemorrhage. Sometimes it's very traumatic because the baby's born early and might be ill. There's a whole range of things, actually, and quite often it's a combination of things. And then what we tend to find in almost all cases is that it's not just the fact that the birth itself was traumatic, but that the interaction with health professionals was very distressing, and that women aren't told what's going on, or they feel dismissed. So they might think something's wrong, and the midwife is telling them, no, everything's fine. They're sometimes made to feel silly for, you know, they're making a fuss. And all that kind of adds to the distress. So that kind of interaction, that interpersonal element of it, seems to be a very strong part of birth trauma.
And Jill, you very bravely have shared your story in public. And I just wondered if you could tell the listeners briefly the experience that you had. And when was it that you first came across the term birth trauma, or realised that you were actually suffering from this yourself?
Yes, so I had my baby 13 years ago in November. I had never heard of the term of birth trauma. I hadn't even heard of the Birth Trauma Association until my son was five. So I did spend those 5 years wondering what on earth was going on with my brain and why my life was so chaotic, basically. But what actually happened during the birth was that my baby was 6 weeks early. Because he was 6 weeks early, it meant he was small. And because he was small, he couldn't help himself out of the birthing canal. He got stuck, his heart rate crashed, and it turned into an emergency. What happened then was the midwives and the consultant had to rip him out using Neville Barnes forceps. This caused a fourth degree tear and a rectovaginal fistula and a perineal abscess. But critically, all of these injuries were missed by the hospital. And I spent 5 days in the hospital complaining and saying I was in severe pain, saying that I was completely incontinent both ways. I was eventually found by a male midwife 5 days after the birth, collapsed in the corridor, barely able to speak. And I was told that maybe it was my perception of the pain. So like Kim has said, for me, the birth itself was pretty scary, but actually my trauma came afterwards by the fact that I wasn't listened to, by the fact that I was ignored, and that I was completely dismissed as having sort of imagined the level of my pain. And about 7 days after the birth, I was then fitted with a permanent colostomy. A colostomy is a stoma. A stoma is where you have a section of your bowel brought out onto your abdomen through a cut about the size of a 50 pence piece. Out of this stoma comes your bodily waste, which is collected into a stoma bag. And I've had that for 13 years.
Wow. Well, Jill, firstly, thank you so much for sharing your story. I think it's really important for other mums out there to know, that things actually can go wrong during childbirth. And I was really struck when, you know, I also suffered from a birth injury myself. I was really not aware before I had my first baby that that was something that could happen to me. And I think that's a really important question for us to think about, is this kind of piece about education for new mums and what should they know before birth. And Kim, how much sort of education are we giving mothers in the UK to sort of prepare for risks, to make sure they know what might happen, to make sure that they're being asked for proper informed consent during labour?
We're really not giving mums, not giving pregnant women enough information. And there's this really kind of condescending, paternalistic attitude towards pregnant women, which is that if we tell them about the things that can go wrong, then that will frighten them. And it's very important not to be frightened. But I think most of us would agree that it's more important to know what you're going into and what the risks are, and assume that women are intelligent enough to understand those risks. Because what happens if we don't know the risks? It then becomes much more frightening when something goes wrong in labour and you have to make a decision. So we did, in sort of summer 2024, for our awareness week, we did a survey on informed consent. So asking women about whether they felt they were given the informed consent to certain procedures. And quite a lot of cases were things like forceps, women had absolutely no idea beforehand, you know, what forceps entailed, you know, what damage they might do. And at the point where you're in labour and it's a medical emergency, and you're just suddenly asked to sign something very quickly. And for some of the women who wrote us, they could barely write their own signature, you know, let alone think rationally about what they were being asked to do. So I think it's really important that women are educated pre-birth about risk. Lots of NHS trusts no longer offer antenatal classes, so I think that's a big problem. So women might not have any education at all, or they might go to NCT classes, which I think vary in quality. So some might give you good quality information and some might not, I guess. Some might kind of minimise the problems that can occur during labour. And then women, they're sometimes left relying on what they find on the internet or what friends will tell them. And I think that's not an ideal situation, really. Because if you went into hospital for any other reason, you know, for all bladder operation, the doctors would talk you through what the risks were of that operation, you know, what the risks and benefits are. And that doesn't happen with birth.
I think that's such an important point. I think I remember I've been in labour for 40 hours when I was asked to sign a piece of paper, and I honestly couldn't tell you what it said. And I was certainly in no fit state to be signing a medical consent form. And Jill, Kim's just made some really important points there. I mean, how much did you know about the risks? And I think it's really important that we do tell listeners that, of course, what's happened to myself and Jill is still the minority. And we are talking about a small proportion of births in the UK. So I don't want to frighten mums out there who are thinking of having a baby or are currently pregnant. You know, people who suffered from third and fourth degree tears like ourselves are still a very small proportion of births. But I do think it's important that we do break the taboo by having a frank conversation about potential risks that there are. So how much did you know, Jill, before you had your son?
Nothing, basically, because my son was born at 34 weeks. I didn't have any antenatal classes at all. I remember I had my own book that had literally one line about severe tears, and that was all I knew. And I think it's really important that we're not patronised and we are given the full information, because when you've had a baby, of course, your head's all over the place, isn't it, as well as your body. And you're questioning everything all of the time. And if you aren't aware that actually this is what it can feel like and these are the problems you may have, then you're not really then able to speak out properly and get support and to say, actually, I think this is possibly what's happened to me. Instead, I spent 5 days questioning my sanity. And then that sanity was then questioned by the hospital, which, of course, didn't help. And I think, you know, knowledge is power at the end of the day. And we need to empower women to give birth safely and to be able to seek help afterwards if it has gone wrong, which, like you say, Theo, is rare, but just because it's rare doesn't mean we shouldn't be prepared for it.
Yeah. And Jill, would you mind sharing some of the symptoms that you've had? Because I was very struck since I chaired the Birth Trauma Inquiry how we don't seem to talk about this as an issue. I think all the focus seems to be on either the mum when you're pregnant or then the new baby when they arrive. But there doesn't seem to be enough attention to the mum and making sure that she's got the right support for her physical aftercare. So what are the kind of symptoms that someone who might have a tear would be suffering from?
Yeah, so for me, like I say, I had the fourth degree tear. So a fourth degree tear is the worst category of tear. That's when you're split all the way through the rectum, the vagina, the internal and external sphincter. So that's pretty serious. Obviously, there's an enormous level of pain because you've been cut, usually, not always. Sometimes you are literally just torn. So you've got a lot of pain around the perineum. For me personally, I had feces coming out of my rectum and my vagina. So the reason I had poo coming out of my vagina is because I had a rectovaginal fistula. A rectovaginal fistula is when you've got an opening, a connection between the rectum and the vagina, and that's why the poo was managing to come out of my vagina. I was also extremely hot. I had a really high temperature. I was really dizzy. And after 5 days, I wasn't really able to communicate well at all. I mean, I think you can probably tell during this conversation, I'm more than capable of communicating with people, but I wasn't able to at that point. Mentally, it took an awful long time for me to to live a stable life. I lived in a state of permanent hypervigilance. So by that, I mean, you have like an impending sense of doom all the time. For example, the kind of adrenaline rush that you would get if you stepped out in front of a car and it just missed you. And that level of adrenaline rush where your heart is pounding, you're sweating and you're on high alert. I lived like that all the time for years. And like you've said, Theo, that there does seem to be an awful lot of attention on the babies, and you are told an awful lot of time, well, at least the baby's okay. And I do remember distinctly saying many times, well, yeah, but what about me? I'm a person too. I had severe depression as well. I didn't sleep at all. I didn't bond with my baby, not until about a year. And that has a huge impact on you as a mother when you're not feeling like you've bonded with your baby like you feel that you should, and like I later did. So that was my experience.
Imagine being told your son would never be able to walk or talk. When we didn't know where to turn, Erwin Mitchell were there.
Our legal and financial experts understand the impact of a serious injury. We help our clients receive the best possible medical care, rehabilitation, and compensation.
My son is now 12. He can walk, he can talk, and he makes me so happy.
At Erwin Mitchell, we'll help you to imagine what's possible so nothing feels impossible. Authorised and regulated by the Solicitors Regulation Authority.
Yeah. Well, Jill, firstly, I'm so sorry to hear that. And we'll talk a bit later in the podcast about resources that mums can get for help. But I just want to pick up there, you mentioned about getting depression. And Kim, I know the BTA has done a lot of work on post-traumatic stress disorder for mums. So could you just talk a bit about where that came from, the kind of the history about PTSD now being ascribed to mums rather than in the sort of traditional setting of veterans in a war zone? And what kind of symptoms might they display? And also, what kind of help is out there for mums who might be struggling with their mental health post having a baby?
Yes, and the history of PTSD is quite interesting. So I won't go into the whole history, but in 1980, it was officially kind of recognised as a diagnosis that came about because of veterans returning from Vietnam had this kind of set of symptoms like flashbacks, like that sense of being on high alert that Jill described so brilliantly. And eventually that was kind of recognised as a psychiatric disorder. But of course, the difficulty with that it has become fixed in people's minds as something that only happens to soldiers. And of course it doesn't, because they started to realise that rape victims show these symptoms as well. People who've been in other kinds of traumatic events, car accidents, violent assaults, that kind of thing. And then in the 1990s, there was some sort of research tentatively suggesting that you could develop PTSD after traumatic birth. And there was a lot of resistance to that initially, because there's this idea that birth is always a joyous event, and therefore it can't possibly be sufficiently traumatizing to cause PTSD. But in fact, after there's been more and more research, it became quite clear that actually a lot of women were showing symptoms of PTSD after birth. So that sort of started to change in the 2000s, really. We were founded in 2004 at a time when there was still that resistance. But gradually, people started to realise that, yes, you could have PTSD from birth. And there's sort of four categories of symptoms with PTSD. One is the one that I think everybody knows about, which is flashbacks and nightmares. These kind of intrusive thoughts that just kind of come into your head they're like kind of completely reliving the experience. It's not just that you see what happened again. You might kind of hear and smell as well. All things kind of associated with the trauma tend to come back to you. What Jill described about being intensely anxious all the time, intensely frightened. So some women won't go outside because they think something awful is going to happen. I remember one woman saying that she wouldn't even go to the shopping centre in case there was a bomb. It's that kind of extreme sort of thing. Or, standing watching over your baby to make sure it's still breathing. That's the sense of being on high alert. And then women will also avoid any reminder of the birth because it might trigger those flashbacks. So walking past a hospital, for example, going to see your GP, watching a program about birth on television. And then the fourth category is sort of something called negative cognition, which is really things like feeling depressed, feeling guilty, because loads of women feel guilty about the fact they didn't bond with their baby, or, you know, they didn't have the birth that they felt they should have done, and that was somehow their fault. And so tied in with that, then you get things like, yeah, so difficulty bonding with a baby, or alternatively becoming, you know, over anxious about the baby, difficulties in your relationship with your partner. People often become very isolated from friends and family because they tend to say things like, you just need to move on and get over what happened to you, which isn't, you know, that isn't an easy thing to do. And in fact, you can't just decide, I'm going to get over this. So that sort of feeling of having birth trauma is actually a very, very lonely experience a lot of women find, because nobody's listening to what they're going through. So that's where we come in, really, is, you know, if you come to us, we will listen to you and we'll recognise what you've been through. And that's really, really important for a lot of women. And I suppose one other thing to say is, in terms of rates of PTSD, the research suggests it's between 4 and 5% of women after birth, which is about 25,000 to 30,000 women a year in the UK. So that's a lot of people, with many more than having some trauma symptoms.
Jo, just to pick up on Kim's point there about bonding with your baby, I remember when I was pregnant, I was so excited for that first kind of, you know, golden hour that you always read about, of how your, you know, child is going to magically crawl up your chest and she was going to start breastfeeding straight away.
Yeah.
You know, what happened to me was I got rushed into emergency surgery and actually didn't see my daughter for several hours, and I certainly wasn't able to breastfeed her for several days. So the expectations and the reality of what we face in childbirth are not necessarily the same. So could you talk a bit about that initial moment of separation from your son, and what it felt like, and you know, what mums who are feeling that guilt that they haven't been able to bond with their baby, to give them some sort of advice of what they should do?
Yeah, so when Sam was born, he went straight into special care for 6 hours. And I remember he was brought into the ward. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, so it was completely dark, completely silent. And my son, my husband and I were sort of looking at this tiny little thing in this cot. And I remember just sort of looking and thinking, this is really weird. Like, how is this baby connected to me? Like, I haven't even, you know, one moment I was pregnant and the next minute I've got this sort of creature in a ward with me, and this is my son. And I wasn't really bothered by the fact that I wasn't bonding with him at the start, and that actually indicates how poorly I was, because I'd just gone straight into survival mode. And my husband actually refers to it as the potato months, because he might as well have been a potato. You know, he said he knew that I was looking after him and I was making sure that he was well, but he could see that I didn't have the same level of bond that he did. And I do actually distinctly remember when I'd moved back home after 7 months. I'd actually moved back home to be with my family because I was completely on my own, away from everybody. And I remember sitting on the sofa and looking at my son and falling in love. And I remember that moment distinctly. And it was at that point that I realized what I'd missed. And that's when I got really upset, because I thought, oh, this is what I should have felt all along. Fortunately, I'm a pretty pragmatic person. And I didn't really beat myself up about it, because I just thought, well, you were really unwell and there's nothing that you can do about that. You can only move forward and increase the bond that you have. And I think that's a really important message to give mothers, that it is not your fault. And if you don't bond with your baby, it's because you're poorly, and actually your brain is protecting yourself, because you're so mentally unwell, you can't actually take on board the level of love for another human being that you can when you're better. So for me, my message is always about hope. You know, there is definitely hope, and I got that bond, and 13 years later, you know, I can't imagine never loving my child.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point for mums who are worried about their bonds with their baby, that it's not their fault. And if they're recovering from, you know, major surgery or having to go into the emergency theatre or having any kind of difficulties, that firstly, there is help out there. And secondly, that you're not alone, and that lots of mothers have written to all of us to share their stories and similar experiences. And could I just pick up on the point you mentioned, Jill, about your husband? And to be honest, I don't think we talk enough about dads and partners in this situation. And it's pretty terrifying for them to see, you know, their partner and the mum of their baby going through a difficult time. Was there any support out there for him? Was there any coping mechanisms that he used that he found helpful in the scenario he found himself in?
There was absolutely no help for him. But I do have to say, I don't think he would have reached out and got it anyway. I mean, he's a former Royal Marine, you know, he's that military guy. So he just went into military mode, and he's an incredibly patient man. And he said, you know, he really, really struggled, not only seeing how devastated I was and all of my injuries, but he really struggled to comprehend how I couldn't love our son like he did. And he found that very, very difficult. But at the same time, he knew I wasn't well, and he just gave me the space to get better. He just approached it really calmly and methodically. He knew me as a person, and he knew that me as a person would come back. And he just gave me the love and the time to do that, really. And I feel very lucky, because I know not every woman has that kind of relationship. And don't get me wrong, it was tough. We went through some very, very tough years, but his patience just saw us through, really.
Wow. Kim, obviously the Birth Trauma Association provides a lot of support for families who've been affected by birth trauma. Firstly, can I ask, what sort of treatment is available out there? And are there any specific resources that you could direct listeners to who are looking for help?
Yes, in terms of treatment, I mean, one of the really good things is there are two therapies that work very well for trauma. One is called trauma-focused CBT, and the other is EMDR, which stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And they're both quite intensive therapies, so you might need 8 sessions, 12 sessions, maybe more than that, you know, depending on how severe the trauma is. And both of those therapies are trying to do the same thing, which is to make sure that the trauma isn't completely present in your mind all the time. Because that's the kind of, you know, that's the real characteristic of PTSD and trauma response, is that you're reliving the trauma all the time. And it's to kind of move that trauma into your sort of long-term memory so it's not bothering you. And of course, that's kind of very difficult, because to do this kind of therapy, you do need to relive the trauma to some extent, which is quite painful. But they do get good results, and they're both treatments recommended by NICE. And for me, it's been wonderful to see women who have been through that and, you know, go into those therapies thinking, I'm never going to get better, you know, I'm always going to be like this, and then come out the other end actually feeling, if not completely recovered, then able to, you know, more or less recover, so they can cope with their daily life again. I mean, I think a lot of women will say you never completely recover from birth trauma, but, you know, they recover enough that it's not always present for you in the way it was. So I think that's really important. And you can access those therapies through the NHS, you know, through your GP, or if you're in England, through, you know, the Talking Therapies service, you can self-refer. So that's all good. I have to say, you know, the NHS is very overstretched, and they, you know, you get sometimes get waiting lists for these therapies, so it's not always easy. In terms of resources, I'd also recommend, you know, you have people have a look at our website and see what we've got, and, you know, join our Facebook group as well, which is a very supportive place.
And I think that's such a useful list. And if I could just add to that, I think also for women to do a debrief post-birth, I did a birth reflection session. And I think when you're mid-labour, you're, you know, so out of it in the pain and the exhaustion that you feel, and actually going back sometimes, you know, several months later to go through the timeline of what happened to you in hospital, some women like myself can find really helpful to sort of process those memories. And Jill, you mentioned right at the beginning that, of course, you were a police officer. And then obviously you suffered from a 4th-degree tear and had injuries, which obviously would have seriously affected your ability to do your job. So could we talk a bit about sort of long-term impact on going back to work, how difficult it is? Because I know a lot of mums who write into me ask that question of, like, will I have to give up my job now I've suffered from birth trauma? How is it that I can get back to, you know, doing the role that I did before, given the symptoms that they now have to live with on a daily basis? So could you tell us a bit about that?
For me personally, because I was a police officer, it's quite a you know, I maybe might have been able to go back into an office, for example, but I couldn't go back onto the front line with my mental health problems that I had. You know, I wasn't able to manage myself, let alone someone else having some sort of crisis. So that was part of the reason that I wasn't actually able to go back onto the front line. And in terms of my physical problems, I mean, it took a year before my septic fistula tract was repaired because fistulas are extremely complicated surgeries. And for my stoma, I mean, you can actually now be in the police with a stoma, but at that time, they didn't really know what to do with me and I didn't know what to do either. So that was kind of the agreement that we came. However, since then, I have done a lot of things. You know, I've become qualified as a lifeguard and a swimming teacher and a tour guide. And I've worked from an MP, actually, doing casework. I've set up a charity. I've worked in a pet shop. You know, that it hasn't ultimately stopped me from living a really full life in the employment sector. But I think at the very beginning, you know, you do actually have to have that time sometimes out of work to recover properly. I was very fortunate. The police did give me, you know, when you have a baby, they gave me money to support me afterwards. And then I did get a small medical pension. But I think really it's about what the severity of your injuries might be and the level of your mental health issues, what they are, that will determine on how well you are initially able to get back into the workforce. But for me personally, I certainly have been able to go back to work and do a huge variety of things after a period of time.
And Jill, you're being very modest in your description there of the things that you've done post the birth of your son. But I just want to tell listeners that Jill is really an extraordinary mum because she's actually swum the channel, the first woman in the UK to do so with a stoma bag. And Kim and I were, you know, cheering you on, tracking you, watching you swimming across the channel, which is really an astonishing experience for anyone to do, let alone someone, you know, who's been through what you did. And I think it's a really inspiring story. So could you tell us why you decided to swim the channel and, you know, what was it like?
Well, the first thing I must do is correct you and say I'm not the first British woman to do it with a stoma bag. I'm the first person in the world. So I have beaten the men. So I always like to say I beat the men. No man has done it with a stoma either. And what propelled me to do it? Well, spontaneity and a bit of madness, I think. Someone just asked if I fancied doing it. And I thought, well, why not? This is a really, really eye-catching way of drawing attention to women injured in childbirth. And, you know, showing that you can do anything with a stoma, but really ultimately to show my son that his birth hasn't ruined my life. And that was really my whole focus for the whole thing. And that's what I did. I mean, I trained for 3 years. I'd never swum more than a mile in my life before I started. I was frightened of swimming in the dark, in the open water, on my own, next to a boat. You know, a huge myriad of things leading from watching Jaws in the 1980s, which was probably a bit of a mistake for many of us. And the swim itself was actually epic because I trained so hard for so long and I was so pleased to finally do it. I landed in France after 13 hours and 53 minutes on the 11th of September 2023, and I raised over £50,000 for my charity while doing so. So, and I have a tattoo of it on my arm, much to my parents' horror.
Well, I think that's such an inspiring story, Jill. That's really a fantastic example of, you know, having a birth injury and having had mental health issues post-birth hasn't held you back. Yes, you've had a period of recovery, but, you know, you have recovered and other mums can too. And Kim, if we just pick up on this point about sort of family and relationships, the BTA obviously works with mums across the country. Could you talk a bit more about the kind of long-term effects on birth trauma? And I was really struck when you and I were both reading submissions to the UK Birth Trauma Inquiry that mums were writing to us not just in the last few years, but from sometimes decades ago, who didn't feel like they could talk about it or share their experiences. And I personally think, you know, there's never a wrong time to ask for help. It's never too late. You always can ask for some kind of way to recover. What do you think we could do to help with families and relationships that are being affected by birth trauma?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's such an important point about how long this can affect you. You know, as you said, we had women writing in whose birth trauma was in the 1980s or, you know, in some cases the 70s or 60s, and saying they were still affected by it. You know, they're still having flashbacks, they're still feeling that kind of sadness and that, you know, the hypervigilance that they'd had at the time. And, you know, that's really upsetting to read, because nobody has supported these women. You know, the help is there, but they haven't been able to access support, which is incredibly sad. I think you're right to say it's important to help families as well, you know, not just the women. It's important for the partners and the rest of the family to understand what you might be going through after a traumatic birth and to kind of show sympathy and consideration for that. Because, again, with some of the ones that came in to the inquiry, I did write back to a few of them, and quite often I heard back saying, "You're the first person who said to me, you know, I'm sorry for what happened to you." And that's really awful as well. You know, think that nobody else has said that. You know, these women have often been through really, really terrible experiences. So I think what I would say to women themselves is, you know, sort of do reach out for help. You know, go to your GP, self-refer to talking therapies. You know, please come to us and our support groups. We have a team of peer supporters who are contactable on support@birthtraumaassociation.org.uk. So do reach out for help, because help is available, and it can make things better. Also, if you're the partner of a woman who's had a traumatic birth and you feel affected by it, again, do reach out for help. You know, we have two dads on our peer support team who, you know, are very willing to offer help. And again, if you have, you know, if you're a partner who has PTSD, then do see if you can access sort of therapeutic help for yourself as well, you know, because that help should be available. Going back to what Jill said, which I think is really important, you know, she felt she didn't bond with her baby, but all that time she was looking after him, you know, she was doing all the things she needed to do. And women often feel this huge guilt that they haven't bonded, but actually they're still being good mums, you know, they're still doing the best for their baby. And I think that makes a huge difference. And quite often there are other family members who are sort of stepping in and doing that care as well, like your husband was bonding with your baby. So I think that kind of guilt that you feel, you know, to try and unburden yourself with that guilt, because you know, as Jill said, you know, she wasn't a bad mum, she was just ill, you know, she was protecting herself. And eventually most mums do bond with their babies, it just kind of takes some time. So I think it's really important to take that away.
That's such an important point. And Kim, you mentioned there about the Birth Trauma Inquiry. And of course, you ran the Secretariat for us in Parliament at the time. And I was very struck by listening to the mothers that gave evidence, how many of them said to them that they weren't being listened to in hospital by healthcare professionals or other people in a medical environment. And I think it does sometimes create a sort of culture of a lack of trust and makes mums unduly anxious. Jill, I think you've experienced similar. So what can we do to make sure that mums feel like they are being listened to, and what role can their partner play in sort of being an advocate for them during labour and post-birth?
Well, the most important thing is to actually give the partners a voice in the room, not keep them to the sidelines. They know their partner better than anybody else, and they're certainly able to interpret what they might be feeling much better than a medical professional who's never met them. So I think that's the first thing, is to actually let them in the room and to listen to them when they're communicating on behalf of their partner. For a woman or a birthing person, once they've given birth, it's pretty simple. Just sit down and actually listen to them when they're telling you things, and record that information. Really crucially for me, all of the times I was pulling the emergency buzzer and saying I was in a lot of pain, and the fact that I was incontinent wasn't written on my notes and wasn't passed around the team. And so that, of course, then makes you feel like you're not being listened to, because you're having to repeat your story again and again and again. So that's really crucial in getting respect and getting that trust. You've really got to have trust between the patient, the partner, and the hospital team, because you're so incredibly vulnerable. You know, that trust is really, really finite at the beginning anyway. So it doesn't take very much for that whole trust to completely disappear. And I really do think that does impact on people's mental health problems when that trust isn't there.
That's really helpful. And Kim, one of our recommendations in the Birth Trauma Inquiry was about more support for partners. But could you just talk a bit about the sort of headline recommendations that we had in the report of how we think we can improve maternity care in the UK?
So the main ones we had, the sort of big headline recommendation, was to create a national maternity strategy. And this would be a sort of living document hosted on the government website, so it could be regularly updated. And that we would also appoint a maternity commissioner, so a maternity czar, to use the popular parlance, who would be responsible for driving that strategy forward. And the reason we felt that was important was, over the years, there have been quite a few different initiatives for improving maternity care, and it becomes very fragmented, and health professionals don't necessarily know what they're expected to do. So we thought just having a sort of central strategy that was driven from the top was really, really important to effect change. And then we had quite a lot of recommendations underneath that. I think there were 12, weren't there, Theo? Implementing the OAC care bundle, which is a way of reducing the sort of obstetric tearing that Jill had, and making sure that was rolled out throughout the country. Improving antenatal care, making women aware of their own kind of particular risks during childbirth, and improving postnatal care, making sure that every woman had the sort of 6 to 8 week check with her GP, and that she was asked about her mental and physical health. Because one of the things we know at the moment is that often either those checks don't happen, or they're focused solely on the baby. So kind of a lot of things that involved, that were really to do with focusing much more on the mother and what was happening to her and her needs. And we thought if we could just kind of change that focus, really, to make sure everybody's kind of focused on improving maternity care and making it more woman-centred, then we could actually make a difference and reduce the incidence of birth trauma.
So a question I always like to ask every guest is, imagine the Prime Minister was listening. What would be the one thing you'd want to ask him to improve maternity care? And Jill, let me start with you.
Mine's pretty simple. Information. Give women information properly before they have a baby. This might be what will happen, and this is what it will feel like if it does. And then immediately after the birth, no matter what's happened, give them information. You know, this is why you're feeling the way that you do, and this is how long it might take to recover, and examine people properly.
What I'd like to do is kind of focus on training, really, training maternity staff, and that includes, but both at the sort of undergraduate level, but also regular continuing professional development training that focuses on understanding the risks in labour, being completely up to date about, best practice, and also focuses on, listening to women and taking them seriously. I mean, so many of the stories we hear are about catastrophic outcomes that arise because either the midwife or the obstetrician has not listened to the woman. And those outcomes can be absolutely devastating for the woman, but sometimes the health professional never gets to see that. I mean, in Jill's case, for example, Jill goes home with a fourth degree tear that has an absolutely devastating impact on her, both psychologically and physically. But the people in the hospital responsible for her birth, they don't have any dealings after that point, to a large extent. So I would that would be the one thing I think when it comes down to it, is that kind of improvement to training. We really need to do that.
Absolutely. Well, I hope very much that the new government will implement the recommendations of our cross-party reports. And of course, I'm keeping up my campaign to improve maternity care. And just to finish off today's episode, can we just get you both to give us one piece of really practical advice or a resource that mums could use who are thinking about recovery or want to get some help with? So Jill, was there anything that you did specifically that really helped you with your recovery?
Unfortunately, when I had Sam, I didn't have any of the help available that Kim said, so I didn't have the EM, all of the different therapies. I basically did a bit of talking therapy, and it took me a heck of a long time to work out how I was going to recover myself. And what I did was I just sort of began retraining my brain. And what I mean by that is I started, anytime I had a negative thought or a bitter thought, I would actively push it away in my mind and retrain my brain not to think in that way about what had happened, and to start focusing only on going forward. And that's really quite difficult to do, because you have, like I say, you actually have to train your brain to do it. you can't just do it. And that took me a long time. But once you have retrained your brain, those sort of neural paths in your brain remain with you. And that's what I did. But like I say, I didn't actually have access to all of the help that is available now. So it'll be much quicker for people and hopefully easier with all of the help they can have.
I think a positive mindset, so important. But, yeah. But also the point about asking for help is really important too. And Kim, what final words of wisdom would you have for listeners?
Yeah, actually, I just want to say that it's so impressive that Jill managed to retrain her own brain, because like, obviously that's what therapy is all about, really. Trauma-focused therapy is about retraining your brain, but Jill did it on her own. So I would say immediately, really, sort of reach out to somebody. So reach out to the GP or the perinatal mental health team, also maternal mental health services now, all of those can help. And do reach out to us at the Birth Trauma Association as well, because as well as offering peer support, we can point you in the right direction.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both very much for coming in to speak to me today. All of the links to the various resources that Kim and Jill have mentioned will pop in the notes for today's episode. And do check out the Birth Trauma Association website. They have a fantastic resource and a really active Facebook group, which I really recommend. And I look forward to you all joining us next week.